This is Intelligence Matters, sponsored by Ginkgo Biosecurity, whose cutting-edge biological intelligence platform empowers national security decision-makers to identify and respond to emerging biological threats.
Our guest today on Intelligence Matters is Nan Mulchandani, CIA's first-ever Chief Technology Officer. Nan spent 25 years in Silicon Valley as a serial entrepreneur, successful founder, and senior executive. Before joining CIA, he served as the Chief Technology Officer for the U.S. Department of Defense Joint Artificial Intelligence Center. Nan holds a bachelor's degree in computer science and mathematics from Cornell, a master of science in management from Stanford, and a master of public administration from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. We will be right back with a fascinating technology and national security conversation with Nan. But first, a message about Ginkgo Biosecurity. Biosecurity matters. What's biosecurity? It's the mission-critical industry safeguarding against 21st century biological threats. Biology doesn't respect borders. Ginkgo Biosecurity monitors critical assets and produces actionable biointelligence for national security decision-makers confronting biological threats, whether they are natural, accidental, or malicious. Ginkgo's technology tracks deadly pathogens worldwide, and our globally scaled platform, the first of its kind, detects outbreaks in near real time, deploys AI-powered threat assessments, and identifies the source of a threat, mitigating outbreaks before they become national emergencies. When lives and livelihoods are on the line, every second counts. Ginkgo Biosecurity, the biosecurity partner for an uncertain new era. Learn more at biosecuritymatters.com. Welcome back. Nan, great to see you again.
Great to see you, Andy.
Thanks so much for joining us on Intelligence Matters. I know how busy your day job is. Look, why don't we start with you telling our audience a little about yourself, how you started in tech other than growing up in the Valley, and maybe describe your path to Washington.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me. And going to love to involve you, by the way, in this storyline as we get to Washington and the CIA. But I will actually start by talking about, I was born in Mountain View, literally at the center of Silicon Valley. It's pretty much as ground zero as you can get. It's funny because I just found my dad's ID from Fairchild Semiconductor from late 1960s. So literally, you know, he and my mom arrived in the Valley really at the dawn of the semiconductor industry. Fairchild was literally the OG of semiconductor companies. So I was born in Mountain View, literally from just growing up around tech and startups. You know, my dad did a startup literally around the time I was born, and still have that typewritten, hand-drawn business plan that you know, I keep in a drawer. But went and got a degree in computer science and math at Cornell, and probably the day after I graduated, got a ticket back to Mountain View to work at Sun Microsystems. And this was 1991. It was the heyday of computing. Network is the computer. And there was no internet, no browser. It was all the intranet. And as in 1995 and 1996, when the browser hit and the internet took off, it was became the new platform. And that's when I started my first company back in 96, a company called Oblix in the identity and access management space. I was acquired by Oracle. Went to a second company, started a second company in the cybersecurity space that was acquired by VMware, then took over a company called OpenDNS in the recursive DNS infrastructure space that was acquired by Cisco, and a fourth company called Scale Extreme that we started and sold to Citrix in 2014. So it was one after the other, without a break.
And then what drew you to Washington and DOD first?
Well, so that's where the story gets a little funnier. So I'd call this my midlife crisis, was to go back to grad school for 2 years after the last acquisition. I had always thought that I was going to go to graduate school sort of early on in my career and do things the right way. And then, of course, four companies later, I realized I hadn't, you know, done that. And so ended up at Stanford for a year. And at the same time, I was actually thinking of a run for office, which was kind of a weird thing to do sitting in California. There was a seat that was coming open, and that was a thing that I wanted to take a shot at. Well, the run for office didn't quite work out, but I was at the Kennedy School and unemployed and with two graduate degrees that were completely useless at the time. One thing led to another. I got to meet a three-star Air Force general called Jack Shanahan, who's a legend in the kind of in defense tech now in terms of the person who set up Project Maven at the DoD, which was one of the first artificial intelligence projects at the DoD. So I met General Shanahan, and it was love at first sight. And he needed some technologists to come in and help stand up the Joint Artificial Intelligence Center. So I ended up as the CTO there. And then this phone call came from a Silicon Valley headhunting firm, kind of out of left field, that there was this secret national intelligence agency that was looking for a CTO. And I know that your fingerprints are all over that, Andy. So you probably have the other side of the story that I haven't heard that the listeners would love to hear. But one thing led to another, and here I am. So I've been on board about a year and a half now.
Well, that's great. And you know, the CTO role at CI is something that we've been talking about for a number of years. And before COVID, we started talking about it. But then, you know, things changed with COVID, and you know, we didn't pursue it. And then when Bill Burns became the director, you know, he put a new emphasis on this role. So, and that's how we got to you. But speaking of, you know, the chief technology officer, can you describe what you see as the role at CIA of the chief technology officer? You know, what is your day job?
Yeah, absolutely. So CTO roles in general, especially in technology companies, are very ill-defined. And it's in some way the same here at the agency, which is, you know, the director. And, you know, when you were there, when I was onboarding, and you were obviously instrumental in getting me on board, you remember we'd sit and have conversations about what does this role actually mean? Because it's not that, you know, CIA has obviously, we've got incredible technology, the breadth and depth, which is absolutely insane when you actually think about the agency's reach and scope at which we operate and have operated for many years. So this wasn't obviously a lack of technology focus. It was that the agency, in terms of its characteristics from an organizational standpoint, is one that really does focus on fixing problems that in many cases are, we're always at the ready to be called in to fix a burning dumpster fire somewhere that's happening, or a problem or an issue that comes up. And it's amazing for me to see everybody at the agency to be able to mobilize. And, you know, the phrase, the first line of defense for the country, really just, you know, like actually, you know, makes me, you know, just goosebumps in terms of the scope and work that we do. But, however, what that does, though, is there are long-range and specific enterprise focus that we need to bring to technology to unify and pull it all together. Because the story arc line in the technology industry over time has been about scale and leverage. And those get built over long periods of time in a very specific way. And we haven't had that luxury, I think, at the agency to build out a strong, solid technology foundation that allows us to build scale. So we're incredibly good at applying technology to solve specific problems. And we do that every single day, repeat and rinse and repeat. But the question is some of the newer technologies that are coming are really focused on scale. And I think a lot of my day job today, being sort of a player on the field, you know, working with the other senior leaders in tech, is really to focus on the sort of 2-5-year problems. And there are three dimensions. I sort of finish with how I distinguish this role versus other tech roles there. So number one is there is a horizontal focus versus a vertical focus. So as your listeners probably know, we're 5 directorates and 11 mission centers. Well, everybody is focused really vertically on the work that they're doing, but the C-suite functions really have to focus on enterprising and pulling all those together. So one is vertical versus horizontal versus vertical. The second is external versus internal. So a lot of focus on engagement with the startup community, with the venture capital community, with the investor community, looking at the horizon of technology, about where it's going, and pulling in hopefully the best of technology to focus on mission needs. And the third one is a focus on long-term versus short-term. So three dimensions of probability difference is what I'd highlight.
So, Nan, I remember after you first started getting briefings about what went on at the agency, I remember you walking into my office one day with this expression on your face of the, oh my God, I had no idea.
Right.
Which is really was priceless. So, you know, given what you just said, maybe you can elaborate a little bit on your strategic vision for technology at the agency, you know, as much as you can, sort of give us a general sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And Andy, I'm sure you remember, it probably wasn't just one time when my jaw was on the floor in terms of what we do. Hopefully listeners will get a chance to look behind the curtain at some point in their lives or career. But the strategic vision really sort of looks like this. When you, like I pointed out earlier, the scale and scope of the technology that we operate with at the agency is very unique. Normal large-scale organizations like ours typically focus in, whether they're a product organization or are a organization that's in a particular vertical like transportation or financial services, concentrates a lot of its technology focus on that vertical or that technology product. We have just an insane toolkit of stuff that we do and deal with on a daily basis that's so broad and wide, it's really challenging to create a unifying story that pulls it all together. So the way I've tried to segment it is the way I've been trying to rationalize it is I bucket it into what I call elastic versus inelastic technology. And broadly speaking, you could break it up into software versus hardware. So one of the things you realize, and I'm a software guy by background and training and experience, which is that digital tech and software tech is the places where you can squeeze the most in terms of scale, leverage, cost, security, et cetera. Because hardware in general, the generational change tends to be obviously slower, it's more expensive, and many of the technologies that we're dealing with on that front are very, very mature. And basically at some point, the ability to, for the valley and for the characteristics of startups and things to mold those inelastic technologies is very limited. So when it comes to greenfields and hunting for the size and scale of operating at that, it's really on the software and the digital and the other pieces there. The other thing is we're a human intelligence organization, right? Human and foreign intelligence organization. And the joke that I have is, you know, human beings are literally the least scalable and leveraged resources that you can get, right? Human scaling in many cases is, it's very clumsy, it's very expensive, it's really, really hard. Human beings are incredibly good at certain things, but digital scaling is really the name of the game. So the vision in some sense is to take our inelastic resources, which are not only our human beings, but the hardware and other bespoke technology we build. And how do you join in the elastic scaled leverage tech to amplify the work that they're doing? So if you're able to create 20% leverage, 2x leverage, 10x leverage, 1,000x leverage, which are very valid concepts in terms of scaling, to the human work that we do, which is the core of our essence of our work, that's where the game gets really interesting. And that's the entire strategic focus, I think, for the technology strategy moving ahead.
So, Nan, you know, the technology landscape, as you sort of just described it, can be bewildering. And as you think about U.S. national security needs, what emerging technology do you believe will have the greatest impact on the intelligence community, national security in the coming years?
Yeah, so the obvious ones, exactly what I said in terms of the sort of scalability pieces, the obvious ones are the ones that are probably well worked over, right? Artificial intelligence, digital tech, analytic tech, anything around scraping and dealing with large amounts of data and finding patterns and creating, you know, incredible sort of leverage for humans, right? All this LLM revolution that's going on is just a massive, massive productivity improvement and changes. Now, it's interesting because these current technologies, especially things like LLMs, are having a massive impact on the consumer side. And while they're going to have a massive impact on the enterprise, it is going to take time and energy and focus to get those integrated into those. A more interesting answer is that when you look at the 6, 8, 10, 12, however you want to slice and dice the emerging tech areas beyond AI, you know, there's a massive revolution going on, obviously, in chip making in terms of specialized chips around that, whether it be for inferencing or for next generation GPUs or AI specific chips. Massive changes in space. You know, in the 30, 40 years that I've been in the Valley, Valley companies would never touch something as inelastic as space. And you're from the space, industry by background and focus. It's just the amount of innovation and startup and capital going into those areas of bending the curve in terms of turning those into software problems. Biotech used to be a hardware business, right? You had labs and you had chemicals and you had test tubes. You talk to CRISPR has basically turned a hardware business into software. I mean, biotech is software now. And so what that does is every single one of these emerging tech areas, when you take it off a hardware commoditization curve and put it on a software commoditization curve, the two easy things are it democratizes the technology to a point where we in the United States no longer have a lock on the IP or the capital flows to fund those, and it becomes something that anybody and everybody can do. So once you start thinking of things like biotech or computing or energy or other pieces there, this opens up the aperture for every single country to not only from an economic standpoint have an advantage over us, but then applying it to national security. I mean, look at the drone market, right? It went from a highly specialized, bespoke piece of technology and advantage that we in the United States used to have. And now you can manufacture one in your backyard now, right? Or with a 3D printer. So those same levels of commoditization, I think, are happening everywhere. And the other thing that's happening is a lot of this stuff has gone dark, which is the thing that worries me a lot beyond the obvious pieces of applying this digital tech to intelligence against us. Is the strategic surprise issues that are happening. So I was talking to a CEO of a biotech company and asked the sort of, what does strategic surprise look like? And, in biotech, in his space. And beyond all the obvious things like pathogens and, you know, being able to manufacture those at scale and the democratization where, various people who didn't have access to it can do it now, is things like human genetic engineering that's going on that could be happening. And his joke to me was, wait for one of the Olympics to happen in 4 years, 8 years, 12 years, and there's going to be an athlete there who is not 5% faster than the other one. It's going to be 3 times faster. And they're going to be genetically engineered, and there's no drug testing or anything that's going to find anything wrong. And all of a sudden, this is going to blow open all kinds of questions. And forget the military applications on this, just the impact on society and other things where you're going to be able to custom engineer, pretty much anything you want in your child all of a sudden. So I don't know. A lot of this is coming. I think it's going to be crazy what we're going to see in the next couple of years.
So Nand, one of the things that you mentioned at the beginning of your answer to my question, one of the technologies. I have a question here from a listener, sort of.
A listener.
I asked a AI large language model, what question should I ask you?
Oh, okay.
And here's what it told me.
Okay.
Given the importance of transparency, how does CI, or national security more broadly, ensure that AI algorithms used in intelligence activities are explainable? And how do you establish accountability for AI-generated insights?
Oh my gosh. Well, this non-explainable LLM asked a very insightful question. So that is the question of the day. There is no question that, and this harks back to the point that I made, which is right now we are in the land of inflated expectations on a lot of these things there, which LLMs being this exact thing. The very things that make these algorithms so great for consumer products and consumer use cases, where my 11-year-old drawing a unicorn with a GPT algorithm is absolutely fantastic, but the same thing applied to the analytic function at CIA or operational functions, which require and demand a whole nother level of certainty and explainability, is is absolutely paramount, and we absolutely do not have it. These are open research projects. I'll give you one example of something that very specific, but very, very relevant to this whole example, is the issue of what I call rabbit holing in these, or actually the technical term is sycophancy. And there's papers on this that OpenAI and Anthropic and others have published on it, where, for instance, what makes these algorithms so brilliant is that they find the receptors in your brain that give you pleasure and give you feedback, and they're trained to serve you. They're trained very well to do the greatest job in supporting you. But what that does is it accentuates the exact biases that you have. It's the TikTok problem. It's the YouTube addiction problem, where the algorithm is feeding you more and more and more sugar, and you're just loving it, and you're going deeper and deeper and deeper. I mean, Andy, you used to run analytic groups at the agency, and I'm sure as a senior leader there and as somebody who's steeped in this discipline knows that in some sense you almost want a co-pilot sitting there making sure that you're not rabbit-holing and going down these things. So these are dimensions of this technology which is just coming to bear in open, and we are spending a lot of time inside the agency working through the more... These are more complicated use cases. So we have LLMs in production. We've talked about it in our open source products, for instance. It's a great example where summarization is a use case for these LLMs that is non-controversial, right? Taking gobs of information and summarizing them into very specific sort of summarizations that nobody disagrees with. So those use cases we're getting in, where I'm very proud of what the work the technology teams have done in terms of integrating this literally within months of work. But we are actually working our way up towards the boss levels of how do we actually transform the work, not just augment it with these pieces there.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with Nand Mulchandani.
Beacon Global Strategies is the premier national security advisory firm. Beacon works side by side with leading companies to help them understand national security policy, geopolitical risk, global technology policy, and federal procurement trends. Beacon's insight gives business leaders the decision advantage. Founded in 2013, Beacon develops and supports the execution of bespoke strategies to mitigate business risk, drive growth, and navigate a complex geopolitical environment. With a bipartisan team and decades of experience, Beacon provides a global perspective to help clients tackle their toughest challenges.
Okay, so Nand, I'm a small company with some tech that I believe has applicability to U.S. national security needs. What do I do? Where do I start? And the reason I ask this question is because a lot of us hear this same question from small companies who think they've got something that is applicable to national security needs, but are stymied. They don't know where to start.
This is a big, big issue that we are really actually focused on right now as we speak. So we have a big innovation, sort of, I call it innovation, but it really is an umbrella of really working through how we get the supply, the demand, and the interface right between industry and our organization. So all of it starts, and I'm actually not worried now about the supply side of the problem, which is we have a ton of companies, well-meaning large companies, small companies, big companies, you know, from every sort of place pushing in and wanting to help. The problem in my mind now is at the interface layer and then on the demand side, where we as an organization don't do a good job of projecting out our needs. No surprise, we're a intelligence organization, a spy organization. We're not really great at projecting out and talking to the outside world. But at the same time, there has to be a mechanism to create efficiency along that. The other is we have also multiple ways of coming into the agency that is a little confusing. So we have obviously an amazing partnership with InQtel. We have something called Digital Futures that does BAAs. We have CIA Labs. We have NVIX. We have a number of different platforms that allow us to engage with the outside world. A lot of our work is done on the high side, at the top secret level. We also find that our supply side of companies that are cleared, I didn't have a clearance till I came to the DOD and to the IC. A vast majority of people in the Valley wouldn't ever get a clearance or know how to get a clearance. So there are these both real and self-induced problems that we acknowledge on all angles, but it is a top priority for us to fix it. And I don't want to announce anything right now, but hold that thought. Stuff is coming, hopefully soon.
Great.
That will help fix this.
Okay, now let me ask you, you and I have spoken about an article that Amy Ziegert wrote a number of years ago, which talked about the divide between Silicon Valley and Washington. So let me ask you this question in a little bit of a different way. And it'll be two parts here. First part is you're now talking to a Silicon Valley audience. What are the two or three things that you would tell them, given your experience now with the U.S. government? What are the two or three things you would tell them? And then the second part is reverse that. You're talking to a USG audience, national security audience. What are the two or three things they should know about the Valley today?
Yeah, I think the divide that you mentioned, I think, was much more of a cultural and philosophical divide that, in my mind, actually, I think some of the aspects of what others have talked about, I think that's kind of evaporated and gone now. I think the couple of years of communication, contact, emphasis and place on technology at the government level, I think, has been great at solving that. And then, of course, the Ukraine war, I think the attacks in Israel, those have all solidified the fact that national security, economic security, and technology security are all one and the same. So I think everybody's in the same boat, singing from the same hymn book now. As far as the cultural divide about what should they know versus we know, that is still actually quite dramatic in terms of the selling and utilizing technology. So on the sell side, so as far as if I'm a startup or a vendor trying to sell technology to CIA, one of the things I've noticed, and this was something that I had to learn coming in a year and a half ago or longer, was what is the CIA's actual mission? And I'm talking specifically CIA. I think there tends to be a misunderstanding, especially from what Amy herself called spytainment in her book, which is people sometimes think don't have a good understanding of the mission and focus and work that we do and impute a lot of things that we do. And so there isn't actually a piece of technology that we don't get offered up as solving some mysterious problem that we're solving in the back there. And of course, we have a hard time either confirming or denying or not discussing the thing that they're trying to offer up. So there is this weird dance that happens in terms of our ability to respond in many cases to that. So that's why, for instance, these updates we're doing on our communication side is to reduce that friction by projecting out the needs that are really important to us, as opposed to perceived needs that people are trying to solve for us that aren't actually important. We're going to reduce, hopefully, the friction and frustration in terms of the work together. The other piece is that we build a lot of bespoke technology inside because there is no app store for spy software, right, or technology. The act of, we're in some cases a monopsony. We're a buyer of one because of the unique characteristics of the work we're doing with this technology. And that requires the vendors themselves to package their products in a certain way that allow us to consume it in an easier way. So when I was a founder and CEO of companies on the other side, a product person, I would try to build packaged products with, for instance, control planes and other things that had no APIs or other things in there. Well, that doesn't work for us because in many cases, we'll take your product, try to disassemble it and get to the heart of it so we can integrate it into something else. But if it wasn't designed for that, that becomes another impedance mismatch. So, there are often issues like this that we deal with that I think is that just more engagement and more transparency, hopefully we'll fix that problem over time.
So last October, Mark Andreessen penned his Techno-Optimist Manifesto.
Manifesto, yes.
Which is definitely worth a read.
Yes.
So let me ask you, now that you've seen firsthand the national security challenges the U.S. faces, are you a techno-optimist when it comes to national security? You know, can technology really help us manage and overcome these challenges? Is that what you think?
Yeah, so let me unpack that. Let me double-click on that a little bit, because I think... Not to explain what Mark did. Obviously, it's a great piece, but it is definitely starting to talk about the Valley is there's a thinking divide going on in the Valley on these two dimensions, and it's actually and I'd say the two dimensions are the techno-optimist versus technology is evil. Right, which is a national debate and an international debate going on. 20, 30 years ago in the Valley, we never expected that technology would have such an impact on society as it has had, because we didn't really sell consumer technology products. Right, it's only the advent of the iPod and now the iPhone and then ad tech, which is and social media, where Silicon Valley, we don't produce computers anymore. We're building consumer tech products and sell advertisements. And this movement from the Silicon Valley, moving from computer systems to these other things, put us in the debate. So that's one big divide, is whether technology is evil or technology is good. And clearly, Mark is coming on the side of technology being something that can solve maybe not every problem, but a lot of problems. And being a technologist, I am an optimist on that in the sense of, if there are hard problems in the world, I do believe that the right incentive structure and the right set of minds and technology put at problems can solve problems. I'm just a big believer in that. And history has shown us that when you put, you know, big minds against big problems and the right incentive structure, things happen. Then there's the national security debate about whether Silicon Valley is leaning in as hard as it should to support national security. And I feel that that debate, in my mind, being especially on the buy side of technology and the receiver, I actually don't, I have not had any companies that I've talked to or engaged with over the past couple of years and being in Washington that have ever walked away from wanting to support national security needs or U.S. government needs. And going back into the Valley and investors, you work with the VC community, there are very few folks who won't lean in. Now, the question is how deep are they into it? Whether they're aggressively pursuing national security support, or are they happy to help in a lightweight way versus being all in? And I think that's maybe the thing that Mark, you know, so... As far as tech good versus evil, I think there's definitely a cultural societal divide that we're going through in the country. When it comes to leaning into national security, I think it's a matter of degree about who's more, you know, into it versus not. I think, you know, Andreessen Horowitz is obviously an amazing investor with American Dynamism and, you know, great tech companies that are supporting us on the intel side and the military side. And some VCs are sitting this one out. Because in some sense, I think it is still a little bit of an experiment, because all the dynamics that you pointed out earlier, the questions in terms of the, do we have the right impedance between private sector and government? And I can only speak for CIA, but having been at the DOD as the volume buyer of these types of products, you know, you're looking at things like Project Replicator and how we're starting to think about the next generation of defense tech and military tech being, you know, I wrote a paper on this. I don't want to hawk the paper, but software-defined warfare. This idea of how do you actually change the hardware, going from a hardware-centric organization to a software-centric organization, how do you go from big vertically designed aircraft carriers and F-35s to attritable autonomous systems? That change is very much one which the venture capital community is leaning into and helping drive. But it's not clear how fast that change is actually happening inside to meet the supply side that is ready to go.
So, Nan, let me ask you one sort of last question. You mentioned next generation, and this ties in there. Michael Morrell and I have now done a couple of podcasts, one at the Bush School here in Washington, and recently one at Yale.
Mm.
And so, you know, what would you, you know, we have a fair amount of college students who listen to the podcast. So what would you tell them, what advice would you give them if they're interested in entering sort of this 21st century technology, national security workplace? What, you know, you've worked both sides of this, right?
Yeah.
The government side and the technology side. So what few words of advice would you give them?
Yeah, the great news is that the awareness and involvement of students in national security and their interest level, I feel, has gone like through the roof. You obviously are, you know, doing great work at Yale and Texas A&M and others, and I've spent a bunch of time at Stanford, at Berkeley, and other universities that we're engaged with. There are now centers, so the Gordian Knot Center on National Security at Stanford, the Goldman School at Berkeley, at Yale, and other places, classes. And by the way, and not only just technology meets national security, but just national security in general, and intelligence as a function and a discipline to study, I think is starting to bloom in a big way. Now, many of these students, and it's been great to actually help recruit many of them. We have a bunch of college students starting actually this summer. Coming in, I know personally some of these amazing, especially on the technology side. We have a student coming in who was building satellites and, you know, as part of an undergraduate, you know, program. Back when I was an undergrad, I mean, we could barely get, you know, computing time, and here they're, you know, launching satellites up into space. So the next generation of students coming, it's just mind-boggling the stuff that they're exposed to and coming in with. What we need to do on our side is meet them a little bit where they're going to be comfortable with, which is the types of careers, the types of tech that they're used to using. You know, the careers that CIA officers had before, which is very long-term careers, and, you know, you're in the agency the whole time. Many of these students coming in probably want careers where they come in, they contribute, they maybe leave for some time, go do something else, enrich their career in the private sector, and they want to come back, and they want to hopscotch around. And while the agency gives officers and employees an incredible way of hopscotching around different areas of tech, we need to make it easier to come and go. And I've got to say, even in my year and a half here, and I know the director and you actually helped spearhead many of these things at the agency before, these career tracks, alumni association, the network, being able to leave and come back and hold your security clearance, stay in your career track. These are all great things that we need to lean in on our side to attract that student body, which the supply side is now starting to increase in a big way.
Non, thanks. As always, it was a great discussion.
Andy, great seeing you. And thanks for everything you did for me, actually, coming on board at the agency. And this has been wonderful.
My pleasure. That was Non Mulchandani. I'm Andy Macritas. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters. And you can always reach us at intelligencematterspod@gmail.com.
Intelligence Matters is produced by Steve Dorsey with assistance from Ashley Berry and Sophia Rubin. Intelligence Matters is a production of Beacon Global Strategies.